Start recording. All right. Thank you, everybody. Hello. So glad to hear everybody. I'm going to have to leave early, of course, again. So I'll have to come back and hear the rest of it at near the end because I do have a class to teach tonight at 10 o'clock. But we do have other mentors and leads that will be helping out. Tonight, we have Lucas Greenwood, Tariq Marji, which I love your last name, by the way, Tariq. Christopher Shook and Josiah Sprunger, who will be speaking this evening. So let's start off with Lucas this evening, if you are ready.
Yeah, sorry, I just walked in the door.
We can jump to somebody else if you're not ready.
Yeah, maybe I can start.
Okay, go right ahead. Go ahead, okay, Tariq.
Just let me share my screen.
Okay.
Could you see my screen?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. So in this project, I'm going to talk about one of the penetration testing type called Metasploit framework. As a red team member, my purpose is to do unethical hacking, which is an authorized attempt to gain unauthorized access to computer system, application, and data. That the red team is focuses in puzzle solving and detective work. My goal as a penetration tester, not to hacking a machine, not to be an evil guy and a bad guy, just the penetration testing to help the client to improve their security through remediation of any weaknesses that I discover. So Metasploit interface, I'm going to start with the interface, is a collection of exploits. And actually, it's a collection of exploits. As we can see in the screenshot here, it does have more than 2,000 exploits, more than 500 payloads, evasions, auxiliary encoders, POST, and NAPS, which can be used through a command line included in the Kali Linux. So this Metasploit is written in Ruby language and has been in development for many years. Okay, and the Metasploit we can use it in for good and for evil. For good, we can use it for identifying the weaknesses, inform the stakeholders, highlight needed changes, protect information and organization, and strengthen the provision. For evil, we can identify the weaknesses and inform the attackers, actually, instead of the stakeholders. We can inform the attackers that we found a vulnerability in a specific target. There are specific ports are open, so go ahead and attack these things. And the highlight target to exploit compromise information that we can do ransomware, taking an information, encrypt them, asking for paying for this. Weaknesses the provision. And Metasploit framework capabilities has contents of intelligence gathering, network scanning, vulnerability scanning, exploitation, and post-exploitation. So intelligence gathering, it works to gather the detailed information about the target of testing. And we want to do it without revealing our intentions. There are two types, actually. There are active and passive. Active, we are probing the target by actively interacting with them to gain information. We might have an account on their website for the purpose of gathering information from the inside. But the passive intelligence gathering, where we are gathering information without interacting with the target. We might read a document that's been provided by the target, check public information sources. Maybe I can use Google search just to gather information. I'm not interacting directly with the target. So this type is called passive. Maybe I can look at the domain information, use third-party scanning service and other sources of information. All of these ways that can help us to find a potential, any potential vulnerability in the target website. Second thing, there is a network scanning. This allows to identify any live host inside the network by, of course, getting the IP address and getting the network subnet and getting all the information after the intelligence gathering. So I can check for open network ports, network services that's running on the target system. We can use a SYN scan, TCP scan, that provide a three-way handshake to the target. We can do UDP scan. We can find a common or more interesting UDP ports in use. Also, we can use Nmap, which is included with Metasploit framework. Nmap, by the way, Nmap is a tool that outside of the Metasploit that does a better job in network scanning. So third thing, vulnerability scanning. Once a target system is scanned and services have been identified, we can look on vulnerability scanning technique. So some scanning technique we can use, we can use a module such as Auxiliary, which can detect if a specific service doesn't require authentication, acquired user credentials can be tested using several Auxiliary login modules. Exploitation, we can use codes that takes advantage of a specific vulnerability. Once the exploit is successful, then we can use something called payload. The payload is a code that we can inject it to the target machine in order to do some to gain access to the system, or we can, for example, use reverse TCP that we can create a shell through this code. And finally, there is a post-exploitation. Once the exploit and payload code are successfully gained access to the target, now where post-exploitation activity come into play. Post-exploitation is a tool that automates the collection of information from the system. Like I can collect the credential of the credential data, modification of the system, and I can escalate a privilege through post-exploitation. So the component of Metasploit, there is a modules contain a scanner, exploit, payload. Some of them we have talked about actually. So everyone depends on the other one. So the first step we can do scanner. We can scan the target, then exploit the correct exploitation code. Then we can do the payload to gain access to the target machine. The modules are the heart of the Metasploit that provide most of the functionalities, include like scan the network, exploit module that exploit the weaknesses of the system, payload that, as I said, is inject a code on the target system. And in most file system layout, in most Metasploit framework, we will find like a directory hierarchy. Under the framework directory, we can find lib, which stands for libraries. Here we can find the internal libraries that Metasploit use. This will be helpful if we write our own scanners, exploits, payloads, add modules that contains an auxiliary for scanning encoders. Encoders, we can encode the specific payload, for example, 200 times in order to prevent a Windows Defender to detect it. So we can work around in encoders, evasion, for avoiding the detection from the antivirus, exploits, payload, and post-exploitation. And we have plugins. Yeah, I'm sorry. Plugins, it's hold the integration code of the third-party tool. So plugins, we can use a third-party tool just to integrate codes for Metasploit. And we have scripts. We have various scripts in Metasploit database that we can utilize during testing. So exploitation, as I said, we have more than 2,000 exploitation. Maybe if you ask me which one we should use, actually it depends. We have to have a plan to use which exploitation to use, and we have to know which platform that we are attacking. Is it a Windows machine, Linux, Unix, etc. And we have to know which vulnerability, which ports are open in the target machine. It depends on the ports that open that we can use a specific exploit and the payload itself. There are more 2,000 exploit modules, and the name convention of the exploitation, it's we can use exploit, then the platform, which is Windows, Unix, Linux, service, is it FTP, HTTP, and the name of the exploit. Actually, I have listed an example here, example that's called exploit. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, here it's exploit Windows local token magic. So token magic is is an exploit that can give us a privilege escalation that give us a higher access to the target machine. For example, if I gain an access to the machine, I don't have maybe I don't have enough privilege to do some task. That's why I'm using this exploit. This one is giving me a high access. Maybe I can give me a guard privilege. I like an administrator on the target machine. Okay. And the payload, as I mentioned, is a part of the exploitation of the target system, which used to inject a code inside the target machine. This code, it has a specific functions. Like I can play an audio file. I can copy files. I can corrupt files, destroy files. We can do many things actually in this payload code. There is a payload here, the naming convention, it's called payload, platform, architecture, then the name of the payload. This example, payload Windows X64 reverse TCP. Reverse TCP means that I'm getting access to the target machine and expecting the target machine to get back to me in the reverse in order to get a shell, in order to get access to the machine. So once I have done the scanning, exploitation, payloads, once I'm done, you can see here in the screenshot, there is a meteroperator. So meteroperator, once I get a meteroperator, it means I have fully access to the target machine. But actually, of course, some commands need to get a higher privilege. So meteroperator is a post-exploitation tools. Included with the Metasploit framework, which uses access to the target machine to provide command line interface and a suite of exploration. Meteroperator is a payload, is configured along with the exploit module, operate completely in memory. This is a good thing that the user or the victim cannot see what I'm doing in his machine because it's doing the work in memory. But some, of course, activities in memory can be discovered by the victim. So operates completely in memory on the target system, nothing on disk. Once we have a meteroperator session on a target system, then we can run multiple commands. We can do something called get info to get the information about the target, what the platform, what the version of operating system, what the user that running the user currently logged in. Shell mkdir, we can create a folder on there. We can do cat, the list cat command that can list, for example, a sensitive data. I can do something called cat a sensitive file. I can see all the data that within the file. Execute, reboot, and can shut down. Some commands to gather system details, registry files, process information, and user's account details. I can create a user on the target machine. Examine and terminate specific process. Load command to load additional functioning. I can load extra extension that is going to help my attack. There is a Metasploit framework that provides extension that can help me to do some extra functionality. And of course, in Metasploit method, there are a client side And we have a server side. A client side is established through forward or reverse connection. We have to have a session. So we have to have a session that connect to the target in order to control the target and have access completely to the target. Server side, just I need, all I need from the server side or from the victim machine is one click to the link or one click to the file. So that file is injected with a payload, with exploitation. Actually, it's ready to be clicked. File to connect back to us and to provide us a shell for communication. Attack methods in active mode. As I said, active mode, we are interacting directly with the target. So we can do scan the target to check any to scan the target for vulnerabilities and weaknesses by using auxiliary, this auxiliary model that help us to scan the target machine. Or we can use, as I mentioned, InMap. Second, we can prepare exploit code that will exercise those vulnerability and weaknesses. Payload code to gain access to the target. So the fourth thing is to trick the victim. We want to compromise the user system by directing their client to communicate with our attack server by, as I mentioned, the reverse TCP. Once the user click, it will communicate with us back. So we wait until the client connection is made. Then our server will send exploit code to the vulnerable client. If the exploit code is successfully, we will get Metaperpeter actually, and our payload is then executed. Maybe we can, as I mentioned, we can use something called phishing email. Phishing email just to send it to the target for something that interested the target. Maybe I can do some, I can do some social engineering that I can check what the target is like. Is he expecting any reward in his email or anything? Maybe I can do fake advertising, a hacked website or anything with a link that will entice a user to click. So I'm going to the demo here. So this is what I have done actually in my lab. What I have done in here, the one that highlighted in yellow, I have done MSF Venom. So MSF Venom, that this command is a tool to create a payload we are using to create our own payload. Dash P means create a payload. What the payload type is a Windows Metaperpeter reverse TCP. So reverse TCP, as I mentioned, we need the client to click with the link or click with the file, then we'll get back to us. In this situation, we can create a session between the target and the victim. Lhost means a local host, which is my IP address, 10.0.0.94. Dash F means a file type. Okay, the file type is .exe file. Dash O output it to download test.exe. So this command is going, again, we'll create a payload, reverse TCP payload, that is going to inject it in .exe file and will be downloaded in my file system, downloads test.exe. Once I press enter, I see the payload size here, 354 bytes. The final size is 73,000 almost. And it's saved in home, Kali, downloads, test.exe. So the file is very big because I didn't specify the platform. Is it Windows or anything? So next, I have to start the SQL, the database, Service Postgres start. This one is the Metasploit is going to use. If I want, for example, to save some files or to do some work, I have to start the Service Postgres before I go to MSF console. This actually is not showing here the command, but I have done MSF console, then pressed enter, then I'm in now. Here is the victim machine. The victim machine has a test.exe. I transfer the file and the victim has double click to the machine. Once the machine, the victim double click on it, then I use the exploit, the multi-handler. This multi-handler exploit that can I use for, maybe it's showing in here, I can use for multiple things, x64, Windows, Linux. Then I have, once I choose my exploit, I then choose my payload, which is reverse TCP. I set, this is the command that when I want to set the payload, set payload Windows Metalworker reverse TCP. I use this payload, that the one that I have created earlier. Okay, and set a host to IP address. This is my IP address. This is my attacking machine IP address. Why I'm putting my IP address to listen to any to be listening on the port 4444, which is the default Metasploit port. That once the victim click on it, I will he will return back to this IP address, which is my machine, attacking machine. This is actually this is exploit multi-handler. Once I show options, I see the exploit is multi-handler, the payload option, that the one that I have created, the IL host is my IP address showing in here, IL port, local port that I'm listening on port 4444. Actually, this one should be changed later about the port, because the Windows Defender knows. Once the Windows Defender see that the victim machine going back to me on this port, it's going to know that this port is malicious port, should be changed later. But they just an explanation. Explore now. Everything is ready here about show options. Everything is ready here, so I'm going to do exploit. Once I do exploit and click double click on the machine on the file from the victim machine, I'm getting Metalworker. Once I get the Metalworker, I inserted a question mark that what the Metalworker can be done in there. Once I click a question mark in there, that showing this whole of things. It have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 slides that showing what Metalworker can do. I can. I'm sorry, I can do multiple things, like I can load Metalworker extension, migrate, maybe it's I can read some data from the channel. I can get read the contents of the file, of the screen, I take screenshot, shut down, I can make a directory. A lot of things actually. There, downloads, I can download specific files. I can escalate the privilege. I can execute some commands. Shut down, steal token, yeah, a lot of things. I can even start a wave, a dot wave audio file from the victim machine. I can insert idle time. Idle time that returns the number of the seconds that remote user has been idle. For how long the user is idle? Maybe I can work in the system while he's not on the keyboard. I can send some key events, mouse, screenshots. I can take screenshot a lot of things actually. Elevate commands. Yeah, I can do some. I can do hash dump to crack the password. At timestamp, I can edit the file date. I get system. Get system, this is a very important command that I can attempt to elevate a privilege from the local system. And a lot of things actually, but I just give a basic things what the Metalworker and what a Metasploit can do. So I think I'm done from my side. Thank you very much, guys.
Thanks, Tariq.
Thank you.
I do have a couple questions, but I'm saving them for the end.
Okay, yeah, sure. I'm ready anytime. Let me stop sharing. Okay.
Lucian, you have a question? Okay. All right. And let's see, Lucas, are you ready?
Yeah, ready as I'll ever be.
All right, take it away. ahead and share your screen. There you go.
All right. So I struggled for a couple of weeks trying to figure out what to do. And last week, there was a question that kind of got me thinking. And the question was, what's the reality of AI soldiers fighting wars? And I don't know how real that seems, but the reality of is that I think the future of war is a cyber war. If not, we're already headed down that path already. So my presentation is on the reality of a cyber war or cyber warfare going forward. So essentially, cyber warfare is the use of computer technology to disrupt the activities of a state or organization, especially in a deliberate attacking of information systems for strategic or military purposes. So all branches of the military have a growing cyber warfare field, the Navy, Air Force, Army. I'm actually in the Army. I don't do cyber warfare right now. I'm a firefighter, but my plan is to reclass to cyber warfare upon my completion with my degree and getting some certifications. So I plan on doing that in the next year. As I mentioned, Army offers a warrant officer focus, which is like a subject matter expert in the cyber warfare field. And then just the Army alone plans to double the personnel from 3,000 to 6,000 for the cybersecurity field in the next fiscal year, with a requested budget under $17 billion for the funding of a for the cyber program. If we had that on the civilian side, I think we could get a lot of stuff done a little more efficiently. If we could have a budget like that at any place that we work at. So some incidents that have occurred with cyber the first reported incident was Stuxnet. For those that aren't familiar with Stuxnet, it was actually believed to be developed by the U.S. And it targeted the Iran nuclear program and started shutting down nuclear facilities over there. It would target their computer systems, and they would hit the computer systems, and it wouldn't throw any alarms or anything, so everybody thought it was fine, but it would start spinning the centrifuges so fast that it would automatically start to throw everything off. And then it grew into multiple industries, pipelines, electrical plants, everything else. And then other various attacks have happened throughout the course of the last 10, 11 years, with the most recent one just August 1st, where a Russian hacker group targeted Lockheed Martin for the HIMARS missiles and throwing off the GPS systems that Lockheed Martin has been supplying to Ukraine to disrupt everything. So as you can see with this one, the attacks on just the U.S. government over the course of 12 years, it peaked in 2015 with just over 77,000 attacks on the government alone. 2018 was just a little over 33,000. I couldn't really find any numbers over the last few years, but I'm sure that those numbers have stayed pretty consistent. 33,000 attacks, you know, that's roughly 100 attacks a day, which is pretty substantial. And then just some random facts about the cyber warfare, cyber war. So 26, a little over 26% of all attacks are directed towards the U.S. With 20% of global organizations believe cyber espionage is their number one threat. So there's definitely a demand for cybersecurity out there and keeping everything secure. 35% of all politically motivated cyber attacks are coming from China or Russia. I think we've known for a while that those are probably our biggest enemies that are after us the most. And then 11% of all cyber attacks are espionage related. So they're after some kind of secret information that we have, knowing what our next move is, where we're going, and various stuff like that. Short, sweet, to the point. That's all I have.
All right, thanks. I was just writing down my questions for you. Let's get this moving. And Christopher, are you ready?
I'm ready. Yep.
All absolutely. Right. Take her away. And thanks, right. Lucas. That was awesome. I liked it.
Good job, Lucas.
Thank you.
Oh, come on. I got to grant Chrome access to my browser. Sorry, bear with me here. Oh, I thought I had this enabled. I've used Teams several times before, but apparently, give me 1 second here.
No problem. It happens. Just on a separate note, I just love hearing how everyone here, just about everyone, is connected to the military in some way. That's just awesome. PGI, Purdue Global, really pushes Marine and their families. I got to take part in the benefits of being the wife of a Marine. So that was awesome when I was going to school.
My husband's Navy and he got his degree at Purdue. He got an associate and then bachelor. And then I obviously got to get some of that benefit as well.
Right, right. And, you know, usually as the wife or a spouse of a military person, you don't get their benefits. So that was awesome when I learned that Purdue does offer that. Christopher, did you want Josiah to do his presentation while you're trying to get your computer to work? Nate stepped away. Josiah, did you want to do your presentation?
Yeah, I can. Okay. If Christopher's okay right. For a second. All right, 1 second here.
Oh boy, am I embarrassed. Sorry, guys. Oh. If somebody else is presenting, that's fine. I'm so sorry. I'm back.
Go for it. You're good.
Okay. All right. Sorry about that. Yeah, I had to let Chrome have access to my desktop, and then it just kicked me off. So I apologize sincerely. Okay, can you guys see my
yep.
screen? Awesome. Okay. In the beginning of this internship, I didn't have much experience with the command line. So, you know, obviously our suite of hacking tools, you know, we would use the command line for nmap, Metasploit, running those services like that. So using a Mac, I would just use the attack box on TryHackMe, which is really what kind of instigated, you know, trying to find, you know, something that would work on my computer. The terminal for Mac, I wasn't having any success running those programs. So I did some research, and there is a package installer called Homebrew that I have installed on my Mac currently. And what Homebrew does is it allows you to, you can go and search for the services that you need to install on your computer, which if it'll switch here. So for example, what really started the use for wanting to use something outside of the attack box is whenever I would try to use the hash ID to determine what type of hash it was, for whatever reason in the attack box, I couldn't get it to label if it was SHA 256 or, you know, whatever hash it was. So what I would do is I would come to Homebrew, and then I don't think it had a hash ID. I think I had it, but let's see, what did I need? Well, for example, if you needed to install Nmap, it would give you basically what you would need to type in to get install Nmap on your terminal. So what I used it mainly for would be for for example, if I needed to determine the hash type of, I think this is a hash that I have stored on here somewhere. Let's see. Okay. So then it would return, you know, so it's a SHA-1. Okay. So then in TryHackMe, you would have to then crack that hash. Oh, there we go. Okay. So bear with me here while I use the terminal here. Okay, and then I'm going to use John the Ripper to crack this hash here. Oh boy, terrible demo. I think I've already cracked it, so it should have it stored somewhere in here. Okay, terrible demo. But yeah, I would use Homebrew, for example, if I wanted to download Metasploit, for example. It would be brew install Metasploit. And then from there, it would fetch that resource and install it onto my MacBook, which then would allow me to use outside of the attack machine, which, you know, is great and all, but I wanted to have that more in-depth use of the command line and the terminal. But yeah, mine's pretty short and sweet too. So yeah, I've gotten more versed with the command line before I started the internship to where I am now. So that's really, that's the length of my presentation there. Thank you.
Thanks, Christopher. Yeah, I've used Homebrew in the past, and as a Windows user, it didn't work so well. I was a bit confused. Looks like we got
It's been very resourceful. I love it.
Yeah, I wish they had something like that for Windows. Felicia, did you have a question?
No. I don't think so, but it's great for the Homebrew.
I just saw your hand come up. All right, Josiah.
Okay.
Take her away.
Am I the last one to go tonight?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Second. Okay, can everyone see my screen?
Yep.
Okay. So tonight I will be discussing data-oriented design. We will be talking about what it is, when to use it, and why it is beneficial. My goal is to provide information on a topic that I discovered recently and I have found to be interesting. So to understand data-oriented design, we need to first understand what that means. Data-oriented design is structured around data-oriented programming. Data-oriented programming is one of many programming paradigms. A programming paradigm is a style or method of programming. So, for example, functional programming, procedural programming, object-oriented and data-oriented are a few of the different programming paradigms. Functional is programming with functions that avoid any global state. Procedural is imperative programming with procedured calls. Object-oriented is programming by defining objects that send messages to each other. And data-oriented is programming focused on decreasing the complexity of data by using generic immutable data structures. So programming paradigms are not meant to be mutually exclusive. Normally, multiple are used together. There are many more paradigms than these four, but the two that we are going to focus on are object-oriented and data-oriented. So let's take a closer look at object-oriented programming and data-oriented programming. Object-oriented programming, as its name states, is focused on objects and classes. Objects are defined with specific functions and attributes. The objects are defined as classes and are able to be reused throughout the program. This makes it easy to reuse written code. However, data within one object is restricted to that object and must be inherited to be used in a different one. This paradigm mirrors real-world objects, which makes it easier to understand how attributes and functions should be created. Data-oriented programming varies due to the fact that it focuses on separating data from behavioral code. It uses immutable generic data structures. This means that instead of being objects, everything is represented as data that can be acted upon. This eliminates the need for inheritance. In data-oriented programming, functions are general purpose and can be applied to large chunks of data. And the main reason for the change is how the data is used and how it's stored in memory. Now that we have a better understanding of the two paradigms, let's start to look at how they influence design. Object-oriented design is focused on the creation of the classes and the objects as it's used in programming. How can each object utilize the attributes and the functions in relation with other objects to complete the program? In the diagram shown on the right, the cat class has methods and variables exclusive to its object. Cat could take inheritance from a bigger class called animal, and will could have other child classes such as dog or turtle. While those other objects may share inherited attributes from animal, they cannot directly access cat's private attributes or methods. So object-oriented design examines how those interactions between objects occur. Data-oriented design focuses on the data rather than on the relationships between the objects. This approach focuses design around large sets of data and the functions that are used to transform that data. The data structures are set up generically so they can be reused. The main purpose of this design strategy is to eliminate unnecessary memory usage to improve optimization. It does this by optimizing the data transformation as the most important piece in designing the program. We can see that the function feed is separated from each individual data, dog, cat, and turtle, but it can act upon them separately. So let's look at a comparison between these two paradigms. As we have talked about, data-oriented is focused around data, whereas object-oriented is focused around individual objects. Since the data is separated from the functions, data-oriented programming is able to scale very easily. Having generic data structures that can be functioned upon makes adding and transforming that data much easier. Object-oriented programming is scalable, but does require more work to create the relationships around those new objects. The main goal of focusing on data first is to receive better performance and optimization. Object-oriented programming can be optimized also, but it can be more challenging due to the focus on the relations between the objects rather than the specific data within those objects. This diagram shows the difference in relationships in object-oriented and data-oriented design structures. Functions must be passed from object to object to interact with each other's data in object-oriented programming, whereas in data-oriented design, functions have a direct relationship with the data. So what's the benefits of using data-oriented design? We're going to look at some performance benefits here. I know this chart isn't super clear, But that's unfortunately the picture that I could find. But I did some research and found an experiment that was performed specifically to test the functionality of data-oriented design and object-oriented design. The experiment was simulating a specific number of cars being processed by data-oriented design and object-oriented design coded programs. The left of the chart shows the time that it took to process those simulations, and the bottom shows the number of cars that were simulated. So there are four different methods that were used to get the results. They were pretty technical, and I wasn't able to fully understand what was occurring in the process. The person that performed the test had a blog post about his entire process and his conclusions, and I have included a link at the end of my presentation if anyone wants to take a closer look at that. I just wanted to show how the performance differs between each method. The green is the data-oriented design method, and the other three are a variety of ways using object-oriented design. Each time we can see that the data-oriented design method processed significantly faster than the others. The main point of showing this is to show how data-oriented design optimizes performance, especially as the quantities of data being worked with are increased. So you can see that on the left, 256 cars were simulated, and the data-oriented design almost cut the time in half of all the object-oriented design programs. And it just kind of continues that trend all the way up until 2048 cars were simulated. So let's talk about data-oriented design in video games. What sparked my interest in researching data-oriented design was its use in video games. Video games originally got me into programming and are still something I am passionate about working on. The data-oriented method is something that has been used in AAA game industry titles for a while, is because early game console hardware was very limited in its processing power and memory. The processing power and memory of those early consoles would have been fine for performing most applications, but because games require a lot of computer resources to be played, it just wasn't enough. In a 3D game, every element is rendered out in individual polygons that can contain thousands of vertices. The thousands of individual points per object add up very quickly. As we saw in the previous slide, data-oriented design's performance has a large advantage over the standard object-oriented design method. Think of what data-oriented design could do for an application that is processing data from a data warehouse, where millions of calculations and operations need to be performed per second. Optimizing performance for hardware is really one of the main goals of data-oriented design. One thing that really made it stand out for me was when a friend of mine showed me an example where he rendered out 1 million squares, which you can see on the right there. He was using the Unity game engine, and it was still able to run at 13 frames per second, which is pretty slow and would be almost unplayable for a game, but is far better than a standard object-oriented design method would do. So he was using Unity, and Unity has been developing a data-oriented design-focused tech stack. It's known as DOTS. So we're going to take a closer look at DOTS and kind of see how it works and how it can be implemented. So there are four main elements of the data-oriented tech stack. They are the entity component system, the burst compiler, the C# job system, and native containers. They call the three main pillars of DOTS. They are the ECS, the burst compiler, and the job system. Together, they combine to form the foundation of Unity's way of delivering performant data-oriented solutions. So the main pillar is the entity component system. This is a framework that provides data-oriented coding in Unity. It shifts the way that game objects are thought about from being the object-oriented containing functions and variables to using the data-oriented method, where it separates the functions and behaviors away from the data itself. You can see here that the entities point to the components which hold the data, and then the systems, which are the functions and the behaviors, are used then to transform the data and perform actions on them. The ECS also allows for data to be arranged to reduce cache misses by the CPU. A cache miss is a failed attempt to read or write a piece of data to the cache. This leads to increase in memory access time and slowing down performance. Using the ECS, developers can also define how data is organized in memory, allowing for quicker access to adjacent data. The other two pillars, which are the C# job system and the Burst compiler, are packages developed by Unity to make it easier to increase performance, along with using the ECS. The job system adds a simple way to generate multi-threaded code, while the Burst compiler is able to generate fast and optimized native code for the engine. Both are really easy to set up and use. And then the native containers are just an easy way to control the memory that is used in the ECS data structures. Every part of Unity's data-oriented technology stack is designed to optimize performance through the use of a data-oriented approach. This shifts from the previous ways of developing games that were poorly optimized to focusing on having a good performance by default, and it provides a bright future for the state of games, especially for indie game developers that use free engines like Unity and don't have the resources or manpower that larger game development companies might have. So what does this mean for the future of software? I think that more programs are going to start being developed with a data-oriented approach. I also think that better integration between object-oriented and data-oriented program will occur. I think that the two could work together well. I also think that there will be an increase in optimization across all software and programs. This is because hardware optimization and the increase in performance is starting to slow down. So I think that the main boost in performance is going to come from the way that things are coded. And lastly, I think that there is going to be some new coding languages that might start popping up in the near future that have a heavier focus on data-oriented design over object-oriented programming languages like C# or Java. Lastly, I do have some resources that I researched and found for this presentation. If you are interested, you can send me a message and I can send you the links to those. My references. Oops, not me to click on that. References for things. And then does anyone have any questions?
I did. I wrote down a question. So it reminds me a lot of databases. Is that what it is? It's databases?
It's a focus on data itself. So the data could be coming from a database, or it could be any kind of data stored within the program itself. But I could see a pretty large use from databases. Like I said, from large amounts of information being transferred into the programs.
So is object-oriented data versus... the other one, kind of like SQL versus NoSQL, or?
They're kind of the same, the way that the data is. It's just that the data-oriented design is prioritizing the data over the functions and the data together, I guess, if that makes sense. So it's really trying to find a way to optimize how the program works with the data, rather than creating the objects themselves with the functions and attributes and variables combined.
All right.
From my understanding. I haven't done a whole lot of research. This is pretty new to me still, so trying to.
Right, and I got a project for you in mind with databases, so we'll get together about that later. Do you know any language that is data oriented? Lucian asks.
I do not. No, I do know. So even though languages like C# or Java or C++ aren't necessarily data oriented, that there are still ways to use them like that. I know C++ is a big one that has been kind of growing that data oriented focus.
Hi, this is a great presentation. This is Dr. Jacon Josiah. I think to help with answering the last question, this is about design. So if you just take kind of, you can take a function-oriented type programming language, but you're going to focus on the data when you're designing your software, keeping in mind that performance is important. So I don't know that, I mean, there may be some languages that'll come out to make things kind of easier, like Unity, because Unity kind of thinks that way, data oriented. But I have a feeling it's going to be more where you can use some of the existing languages, and it's more about changing your thinking to be data focused, if that makes sense. I mean, that's what I think. I haven't done any research either, but no,
I agree. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think that's the main focus. I don't know if, like you said, maybe in the future there will be some that make it a little bit easier to do that. But I think it is more of a thought process on how you do things.
Yeah, and I mean, you could take a language like C, which is a function-oriented programming language, and you can design it with a data-focused mindset. Even with an object-oriented programming language, you know, the idea with object-oriented programming when it came about was to keep your data and the functions and all of that together, you know, and look at it as one object. Now, with this kind of design, now you're taking it apart again, back to more of a function-oriented, I mean, you can, a data-oriented design by using a functional programming language, if that makes sense. But it's very, very interesting.
Yeah, I agree.
Looks like Frank had a question, comment.
First, I thought that was a great presentation. My question is data-oriented programming more of a linear approach versus, you know, object-oriented programming can be like sometimes all over the place?
I don't know specifically. I think I haven't done any data-oriented programming, so I don't know for sure. I think it could be similar. I know that the focus is on setting up the data structures to be used previously. So I know, like, I don't know if this is exactly what you're saying, but if I'm coding in an object-oriented programming language or doing object-oriented design, I kind of just start creating objects, like one here, one there. Whereas I think in data-oriented design, you kind of want to have an idea of all the data that you're going to be using beforehand. I don't know if that kind of answers your question, but that might be something to look into if it's linear or not.
Frank, define what you mean by linear.
Because one of the slides that he posted up was with the car simulation, was that when it was a data-oriented programming, it said that it was focusing more so on arrays. So I was just wondering, like, is it more of a linear approach versus, you know, object-oriented programming where, you know, you have your classes, different functionalities of each object. Right. That's why I was like, right, is it more of a linear approach versus OOP? And then
think about it. Yeah, think about it like this. You know, when you're designing software, typically you're manipulating data, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to think about the best data structures to use, whether that's a list, a queue, a stack, a set. You know, it doesn't matter. You'll choose your data structures for maximum performance when it comes to space and time, like the whole big O notation. It's just more of a focus on data rather, you know, you're not going to encapsulate it together with its functionality, but you're going to think about the data first and optimize that, then implement the functionality, obviously, that you're going to use, you know, that uses that data. So it's all about, I think, data structures and the way, you know, when you think about, like, if you design a database and you normalize it to the best of your ability, it's almost like the same way. So it's the same thing, but you're not thinking database, you're just thinking of the data and how that data should be organized, how that data should be manipulated. I don't know if that helped any, but.
No, I got it.
And in that scenario, with that graph, the person who ran the test, he set them all up differently. So specifically for that data-oriented design approach, he decided to use an array. I don't know what his thoughts behind doing that over the other methods for the object-oriented approach, but I don't think that that was exclusive to just being data-oriented.
No, but it was still a great presentation.
Yeah.
Good job.
Good job. Does anybody else
good job.
Have questions or comments? I do, but I'll wait and do them after. Right. Tariq, you mentioned that Nmap is better. Can you tell me how it's better? What it does better than the Metasploit?
I think he actually slipped out already at 10:05.
Oh man! I had some good questions for him. Okay. So Lucas, yes, so I've heard that old tech is hard to hack. So with that in mind, how hard would it be to target North Korea?
You think North Korea still is on old tech?
I would think so. I mean, they're pretty isolated, although they do have like Russia's.
I think they're allies. Very high. I think they're very high tech.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I think I see North Korea as being a country that kind of stays under the radar because China and Russia, you know, are the forefront, and North Korea is just kind of sitting in the back. I mean, look at the issues we had with their nuclear weapons and stuff. So they're obviously have some kind of technology and advancements going. We just may not know about them.
Right.
Oh, I see. Yep.
And that armies of North Korean, I mean, getting trained on offensive, you know, cybersecurity type things. I have a question for Lucas, too. Do you mind, Angela?
No, not at all.
So do you think we created ZecNet
So it's interesting because the class I had just before this was a cybersecurity policy class, and they just happened to show a clip about the Stutniks, and in that clip it said that nobody's claimed it or nobody's come forward about who really created it. But in another class, they talked about how the U.S. and like other Middle Eastern countries collaborated to target Iran originally.
Yeah, I don't think we're ever going to know for sure.
I don't think we will. I mean, there's probably a lot of stuff we will never know for sure, right? But I think there's a strong suspicion, and I don't think it'd be a surprise if right. we did.
I agree. I mean, I personally think we did. And I think, like you do, perhaps other countries were involved with the United States creating stuff like that.
I'm sure there's many more out there, too.
Oh, yeah.
That's interesting. It's scary, though. I would have thought that more than 20% of global governments would consider cyber espionage their number one threat. That was kind of shocking to me that only 20%.
Yeah, I don't know. 20%. I mean, that's a lot of companies though too out there, right? Of global, you know. I guess how many companies out there really have that big of secrets that people want? Other than like the government side of stuff. I guess the biggest stuff people would be after would be like the technology firms, right? Because that's one of the biggest industries out there right now. Apple, Google, you know, Samsung, all that stuff. For the espionage and you know, what's the next big product or what's the big next technology coming out?
Right, and banking would probably be big too.
Very true.
All right, does anybody else have questions for Lucas? I was going to ask Christopher. So with Homebrew, is it kind of like Node.js? Because Node.js, I can't remember what I was going to say, but is it like Node.js where it kind of has a library of things to pull from?
That'd be my assumption.
Oh, is Christopher gone too? Well, okay then. If nobody has any questions for Josiah or Lucas, I can close the meeting out. No? All right. Well, thanks everyone for coming, and thanks to Tariq, Lucas, Christopher, and Josiah for their presentations. You guys did a very good job. And next week we have Brett, Shane, Stephen, and Nick coming up. And I did want to make a note that if you are graduating with the graduating class of October 11th and you need to get in on the October 6th or September 29th classes to get your master class done, go ahead and shoot Marjorie a message. I think you can sign up, but in case you can't, in case it says that all the slots are full, shoot Marjorie a message and she can get you put on the calendar. So thank you everyone for coming and have a good night, and great job again, everybody. I really enjoyed the presentations.
Yep. Have a good night.